Inoha, please be seated. This environment court resumes.
So, good morning. Now, members of the bench are social distancing because they come from Wellington. So I'm assuming also, Ms. Dixon, that you've brought your level two with you.
Indeed, Your Honour, I'm working on that principle, and you'll see that I have moved myself over from where I normally sit. Yeah. Spread ourselves out a little.
Okay, so Dahlia knows to treat you not with plastic gloves, but
yes.
But something like that.
She had a word with me a few minutes ago.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, very good. All right, so good morning, everybody. I'll just take a quick call through to see who's here. So Mr. Moore, Ms. Malpop for ORC. Good morning, Ms. Williams for the Director General. Ms. Dixon for the Minister. Mr. Page for ORUG plus three others whose names I've forgotten, but anyway, I know you for. Ms. Irving for Territorials, Mr. Welsh for Trust Power. Anybody else in the room representing a party who wishes to be introduced? No one. Okay, very good. All right, so this, first up this morning, we're going to be hearing from our last case. And before we move to him, though, I just need to check to see I know what's actually happening in relation to witnesses to be called. So we've got a few witnesses back for the priorities joint witness statement, and I think we've got notices from you, Ms. Williams, and you, Mr. Welsh, that you had some cross-examination. Yep. Is that right? No? Yes? I think that's right.
I haven't actually put in a formal notice, Your Honour,
okay.
But I would like to.
You'd like to. No, that's fine. Please. And
I did belatedly,
this,
ma'am,
no
in respect of only tomorrow, the objectives.
Ah, okay,
so
you're
for
tomorrow? Okay,
for tomorrow, yes, sorry, that may have not have been clear.
No, that's fine. And so, Ms. Williams, you're for today? Yep, no, that's fine. Anybody else intending to cross-examine? Nobody else, okay. And in relation to Ms. King and Mr. Cummings, we've got evidence filed. Did anyone want to cross-examine them?
Your Honour, sorry, Penny. We may have some questions for them, just depending on how things play out.
All right. So maybe, okay, and Doc.
Yes, please.
Very good. And
Your Honour, just possibly.
And Your Honour, possibly?
On the same basis, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. And then we have JWS tomorrow. And you may be wondering why it is that I'm interested in hearing from all of the planners, not just it seemed to be a representative selection of the planners. And that is because the objective, as proposed by, I guess, two groups of planners, has gone way wider than what we anticipated. And we were, I thought, reasonably clear that the objective, that the purpose of the exercise was to finish tidying up the objective, particularly as it resonated with other changes to do with the schedule and related changes with the rules and the policies. And I do recall Mr. Page saying, or inviting the court to give broader direction on the objective, which we felt that we couldn't do prior to actually making some decisions on people's cases. So for both groups, the objective has gone wider, and we're not sure why or what it's seeking to secure. Yeah, and so that's why we wanted to hear from the planners directly, quite happy to take them in by AVL, but if they're not available, then I wish to hear from Council whether they agree to be bound by the court's decision in relation to the objective, the planners having cast it wider than what the court directed.
Your Honour, it's probably useful if I address this question because it is particularly, as I understand it, Mr. Ensor who's affected by this. Mm. As I think the email that I explained to the court has been passed to Your Honour for consideration.
I haven't read it, so I've been busy with other things this morning.
The difficulty is that Mr. Ensor has another hearing tomorrow.
I understand that. What's his hearing?
It's in relation to A kura kaupapa. Would it be useful if you were to hear from Mr. Ensor directly?
Well, I wish to know whether it is in front of the court or whether it's in front of a local authority, a territorial authority.
I understand it's in front of a local authority.
Mm. This court takes precedence, and it must do, given the importance of these proceedings to Otago. So we don't mean to interrupt his life too much, but would take his evidence in by way of ADL.
Yes, and this morning, after conferring with Registry, I've been talking to Mr. Ensor and others who will be on the panel tomorrow to see if there's some way in which we can make this work. Mr. Ensor was only present, as I understand it, for the discussion of the objective.
And that's particularly where a focus of our interest is.
Yes. Yep. So he had no involvement in the discussion around stranded assets, for example. So that would presumably mean that only a part of tomorrow's panel is relevant to him and for the court to hear his views. We're just trying to work out if this, and it may be easier if we continue to discuss it amongst ourselves, but if there's some way in which we could actually schedule a part of the time tomorrow specifically on the objective when he can make himself available by AVL from Rotorua, which would seem to be the most desirable way.
Yep.
He has also this morning been having a look at where Mr. De Pelsmaker has ended up on the objective and the recommendation that he's made alongside where the joint witness statement landed. So he's been thinking about the differences between the two. And he is here today. If you wanted to...
I don't want to take him out of turn.
You don't want to take
him out of turn? No, I don't want to take him out of turn. We'll do it as part of the joint witness statement. We'll do it as part of the empanelment. It just becomes inefficient for other reasons to be... And I don't know who wishes to examine, if anyone wishes to examine, on the quite divergent methods now under...
Yes.
Outcomes, rather, not methods, outcomes, now under that JWS.
Right. But you would be... you would find it acceptable if we were able to organise a session tomorrow that he
absolutely
can join?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. It is, as I understand it, a hearing that involves something like 138 submitters and has been scheduled for some time. And he's the lead planner on it and the has been the lead, actually, in terms of managing the project. So it's not as if he's simply appearing to give evidence at some point and then can disappear. He has very much a management role in terms of the whole proceeding tomorrow. Without him, I suspect it would have trouble going ahead. So if we can make the two work alongside each other, that would be much appreciated.
And if we can perhaps get started prior to the start time for that event, I don't know whether it's starting at 10 o'clock somewhere in Rotorua, but we could start earlier accommodate.
I'll check with Mr. Ensor as to the details around that and perhaps come back to you a bit later today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ron.
All right. So that's... I think so. For tomorrow's objective, the only party thus far... Is Trustpower and DOC. I might not have taken this down right. Trustpower and DOC. No, not DOC. So just Trustpower for cross-examination on that objective. Correct? Yes. All right. Did you say... Sorry, Ms. Irving, I did take a note down wrong. Did you say you were or were not going to be... You may be.
Put us down as a maybe for both.
You're a maybe on both?
Yes. Yeah.
On both.
Sorry, the schedule had identified some existing parties, and so I had perhaps wrongly taken from that that we were recorded as being able to cross-examine already. So that was for ORUG. I think in the schedule it notes ORUG is cross-examining.
Oh, it just says TBC, and there was a direction that said, look, people, if you want to cross-examine, can you tell the court?
Sorry.
Yeah, okay. And TA is not actually down.
No, I know, not for the TA.
Oh, so not for the TA.
For ORUG,
okay,
yes.
I'm with you. All right. All right. And you're talking about, sorry, you, just to be clear, you're talking about the presentation of the joint witness statement by the group of planners, cross-examining that, or you're talking about cross-examining in relation to Ms. King, Mr. Cummings?
Both, Your Honour.
Both. Okay, I'm with you. For ORUG?
Yes.
Okay.
We We'll reserve whether we actually do.
But I just would
like
issue.
The opportunity.
Okay,
thank you.
And Doc, you are cross-examining the joint witness panel for priorities?
Again, Your Honour, sort of just depending on where Mr Moore ends up, but I'd like to have
Oh, okay, so Mr Moore, you're going to do something?
I thought.
Oh, good. Yes, I'm thinking, well, you're strangely silent despite the fact that the court had actually invited you to assist it. But.
Yes, no, I had assumed that we would continue as directed and I'll
Perfect.
Ask my open questions. And
okay.
I should probably
yep, no,
seek
that's...
leave to cross
if, you need
if something
to do the
arises. Yes.
Yeah, no, that's I'm with you now. I'm thinking, well, I couldn't see how you guys were reserving your position when nobody had actually examined anything. You'd have to start cracking on and making a decision. So, no, that's helpful. Thank you. All right. And then we've got Mr. Dopalsmaker with his reply, which is, I think, we're scheduled to hear that Thursday. And again, what do parties, not, I haven't looked at it, but what do parties want to do in terms of telling the court whether they're cross-examining or not? I expect you would not have read it across the weekend, or maybe you have, but do you have a view? Or do you just need more time to chew it over?
Yeah, I think a little more time.
Yeah.
I've skimmed it, but still working through what it all means.
Yep. No, that's fair enough. So could you... sorry, Ms. Dixon.
I was going to say the same thing applies, Your Honour.
Yeah. It's I don't expect people to have read it. I haven't read it. All right, so if you could perhaps let Rebecca know by Wednesday whether there's any cross-examination required for Mr. Dopalsmaker and his reply. Now, I take it that that's a proper process. I know it's, this is this weird thing that this hearing is, where it's a first instance hearing, but we are allowing cross-examination, and I take it would be an appropriate process to allow, I've just assumed it's appropriate to allow cross-examination on the reply.
Yeah. The case.
Okay.
Don't see any reason why we wouldn't test it.
All right, that's good. All right, thank you. And then when is everybody coming back in terms of the RPS? What's your date for that?
We'll come back to you on that. We'll continue working with council and provide a suggestion as to how we might sensibly manage that.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, we were minded to discuss that with Council today and perhaps report back first thing tomorrow morning.
Very good. Fine. Right, and I see that Dr. Somerville at the moment is down for Friday after your reply, but I've said he is to come before your reply. On Friday, which is when he's available, and at that point he's going to be presenting both on the Vares issue, and that'll depend on perhaps where we get to this morning on that issue, together in a general reply to council on the deemed priorities topic.
I was looking at the schedule as you were speaking, Your Honour.
Mm-hmm. Tuesday. No, Wednesday.
So I've got him after here.
Yeah.
We're closing. And
I see it's a Tuesday, yeah. I think it's desirable he be before your closing.
Yes.
Yeah.
The schedule I'm looking at has him on a Wednesday.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry. I had read that as your closing on the Wednesday, but in fact, rereading it, you're closing on the Tuesday and he's coming after you, whereas I think he should have come before you.
He ought to come before, yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll talk to him about that, but I think he was generally available Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, so I'll talk to him about just how flexible that timing is.
Likely Tuesday morning if we get through the list on Monday.
All right, thank you. So that's us. So we're just going to dial up Southern Lakes and just take the last party's evidence. Do you want to assist us, Mr. Moore? And it's probably prudent to swear Mr. Enright in. So good morning, Mr. Enright.
Good morning, Your Honour.
Good morning, Mr. Enright. I'm now going to swear you in. Would you like to make an oath or affirmation?
Either is fine, but affirmation, let's start with an affirmation, thanks.
Sure. Do you solemnly, sincerely and truly declare and affirm that the evidence you give shall be the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Enright. I'm going to ask you some questions just to confirm who you are and who you're appearing for before I then proceed on to ask you to read out your summary that you have helpfully prepared. But can you please confirm your full name for the record?
Yeah, my full name is Shane Anthony Enright.
And you are appearing today in support of a submission filed by Southern Lakes Holdings Limited, is that correct?
That's correct.
And Southern Lakes Holding Limited filed a submission on Plan Change 7?
That's correct.
And you have also prepared to assist the court a memorandum and a set of planning provisions, and the planning provisions that I have are planning provisions dated the 18th of March 2020, and those were circulated in accordance with directions towards the first weeks of this hearing. Is that correct?
Look, if I understand you correctly, you're referring to the set of amendments that I've filed with the court, yes.
Now, just so I'm clear, the amendments that you are seeking to be made to Plan Change 7, are those still the amendments that are set out in your document dated the 18th of March 2020?
Yes, they are, although I have seen some amendments that have been presented, I think, on the 16th of June, which supports some of those, at least. Yep.
Okay. I will likely ask you some further questions about that, but before we get to that point, do you confirm that the evidence that you're about to give is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
I do.
Now, you've prepared a written summary, and a copy of that has been handed around the court this morning. You could read that summary, if that's what you're intending to do this morning.
Thank you. I would like to. I've provided that to the court at least as a summary or a synopsis of what I would like to present as my evidence.
Okay, if you could proceed with that and then remain for any questions.
Thank you. So, Your Honour, and other court members, I'm representing, as mentioned, Southern Lakes Holdings, which is a farming business today. It's its only activity, so I'm effectively representing the Enright family that has farmed in that region for many years. Came into that region about the late 1800s. I appreciate that the court is considering water users in this process and in the formation of the Plan Change 7 that's most necessary. In my view, it behoves the Otago Regional Council in its application of water management processes to consider not just the environmental implications, but the implications on its region and people in its region and the Otago region. Southern Lakes Holdings itself has invested significantly into the use of its water resources. We have four small irrigation projects. We've undertaken a considerable number of application processes. And to summarise one application process, we've more recently applied for in 2017. That has cost us to date $53,303 simply for the consultant that we've been forced to utilise for that application process. And I think this undermines or explains the complexity of the process with Otago Regional Council today that someone with 2 degrees at university is forced to utilise a consultation firm at such an expense. I don't draw any salary. I've never drawn a salary as a director from this farm or Southern Lakes Holdings, and I've received no income in the entirety from 2007 to 2020, which this is considering. And yet we've spent $53,000 just on the consultants for this process. And that helps to explain the level of complexity that we're dealing with the Otago Regional Council. However, we're forced to do so because these investments are necessary if we're to even consider that a farm would have a sustainable future, and that future today is not guaranteed. And I've simply highlighted a couple of examples where the processes for dealing with the Otago Regional Council have been quite difficult, and I guess it's not dramatic to say draconian. One example is a consent process for a consent that we have, which was number 2692, and my father was informed in 2003 that he was required to renew that water consent, and that's drawing water from an area in the high country known as Humbug Gully. At this time, my father's eyesight was so impaired that he was blind at 50% of both eyes, and he was unable to read those documents. And that's unfortunate, but we did inform the Otago Regional Council, and it had very little patience or consideration of a disability. Under time pressure, that permit or that consent was renewed. But in the process of that renewal of that consent, now referred to as 94655, it resulted in a change in the locations that we were allowed to take water from, and hence a change in the water sources. And that was due to an incorrect Otago Regional Council report on those sources, because the member of the Otago Regional Council producing that report was not familiar with the historical titles of the property and made certain assumptions that my father at the time was unable to really deal with under the time pressure. And that person concluded incorrectly as to their locations. And those forced changes at a time when my father was quite vulnerable have resulted in the farm being disadvantaged. This is one example in terms of my father's. I'm sure you've heard other examples from other members or other farmers in the Otago regional region. My own personal example was in 2013, I received a notice from the Otago Regional Council that they had cancelled the right to take water from one of our water sources, Dunstan Creek. There was no direct consultation with us at the time, so this effectively came out of the blue. It was quite a shock, quite a concern for us, because water resources ultimately for a farm are just so integral and important. So we were forced at short notice to install an irrigation system that was considered under the Otago Regional Council guidelines to be an efficient spray irrigation system. And we were forced to do that simply to maintain that water right. The time frame resulted that we were given to do that resulted in a lack of opportunity for consultation, and effectively we made a poor choice of that irrigation equipment. And in the end, it was found to be ill-suited to the weather conditions, the environmental conditions, and actually our labour requirements. And that was because the irrigator has been severely damaged by a number of times. We have very high wind conditions, northwesterly winds blowing through those areas, and we have flood conditions at times where the irrigation tracks have been repeatedly damaged due to flooding conditions. And these have forced us to have limited use of that irrigator. And it really does need to be simply replaced with a different choice that copes better with those situations. And that's coupled with the labour shortage in this remote area. There are no accommodation within that area. It's a very remote old mining town in central Otago. And so, you know, that particular choice requires a lot of labour to utilise it. But had Otago Regional Council taken a more consultative approach with Southern Lakes Holdings as opposed to the measures that it took in cancelling the water resources at short notice, this farm, you know, would have been much better served by simply the time to research better solutions and would have made more efficient and effective use of those water resources within the Otago region and for sustainability of a farm in the Otago region. But what we see plan change 7 doing now is it assumes that the volume measurements are also reported from a point of take over a national communications network. It assumes that there is access to communication networks that enable you to communicate effectively the water usage. In our region, we don't have that. We're in a remote area that doesn't have a mobile network, for example, and there isn't New Zealand or Otago or regional communications infrastructure available to us in that areas. But Plan Change 7 doesn't acknowledge these basic infrastructure issues, and it doesn't therefore accommodate in Plan Change 7 that there are large data gaps where water usage hasn't necessarily been able to be communicated and recorded. Coupled with the practices of Southern Lakes Holdings on this particular creek, we are part of a community of water users, and in this case we have voluntarily reduced our water usages over time in order to favour other users on the water scheme. And that has an impact also in the calculation of an annual volume limit. So Plan Change 7 in its present form, in the clause of, in this case it's the clause, Your Honour, 10A.4.4, which is a method for calculating the annual volume limit. If we consider that in its present form, it would render this irrigation system ineffective in a dry summer. And I'm referring not to that clause in the form that it was originally when Plan 7 was announced, but in its form as put forward on the 16th of June this year, so which was recently reduced. It doesn't consider the limitations on use of some irrigators because of exceptions such as severe weather conditions where they are regularly damaged, flooding conditions, high, and I'm referring to very high northwesterly winds that come through our region. They belt through. What they do with our irrigators is they tip them over, they damage them severely. We have limited engineering resources in this remote region to repair them, and limited labour opportunities there. But from our point of view, that small irrigation system, which was a response to Otago Regional Council processes, would have cost today $250,000, and it ultimately is integral to the operation of our farm and its sustainability. So what Southern Lakes Holdings and my family is effectively seeking is, and it's detailed in its submissions, which we put on the 26th of February this year, in terms of amendments to Plan Change 7, is simply to recognise that there are exceptions when making calculations to annual volume data that cannot be reasonably expected to represent the volumes that are actually taken, because there are data gaps, and so there is more water taken than can be recorded, because we don't have communications infrastructure necessarily in place, and therefore we have to rely on small companies and the limitations on that equipment, which isn't always reliable. And it doesn't represent the design of those irrigators, which are necessarily designed to deliver the minimum amount of water to sustain the plants and so that they can remain alive. So if we simply use just a limited amount of data available and we calculate our annual volume limits, then those annual volume limits are significantly lower than what we actually need to sustain those plants and those paddocks and which the irrigators are designed to deliver. I just wanted to refer to the inclusion of deemed permits relating to the damming of water and the discharge of water. These are consents that are important to many users in the Otago region. In relation to our experience with the Otago Regional Council, we were required to upgrade the efficiency of our water irrigation system from what was effectively flood irrigation to a more expensive spray irrigation system. And so again, significant investment has been made to develop for our farm the ability to take water, to convey water across large regions of the property, because we are in the high country, to store water and then to install irrigation infrastructure. So Southern Lakes Holdings has invested into a storage dam that's very integral to that spray irrigation system. We have two centre pivot spray irrigators. Without storage, we would not be able to sustain those irrigators over dry summer, simply because the water sources are inadequately available to continue the irrigation without storing water. The equipment on irrigation equipment on two of our irrigation projects are now completely dependent on the storage dam. And those new irrigation systems have taken 5 years to develop, to fully develop, because it takes 5 years to develop pasture, the paddocks, and the fencing systems to match those irrigators to do this economically. Yet those permits are now under review, and that would effectively devastate those irrigation systems if those rights or permits were to be removed. So it seems critical that we consider removing from Plan Change 7, at least, the deed permits with respect to dams and water discharging from those dams. That's our recommendation for Plan Change 7, is to remove the deemed permits relating to dams and discharge from those dams. Plan Change 7, and I'm just referring to the calculation of monthly volumes in this case. Plan Change 7 calculates or proposes to calculate the monthly volume usage over the arbitrary calendar month. So in the case of January, say 1st of January to 31st of January. And this doesn't really represent at all a weather pattern. It has no relationship or bearing to a weather pattern. In other words, if you have a dry month, it may be from the middle of December to the middle of January. And so on another year, it might be from the 1st of January to the 30th of January, but I think it's quite clear that weather patterns don't follow arbitrary calendar months, so that when we calculate the water that we're using over calendar months, that reduces the representation of what is actually needed by those irrigators. So it seems also unnecessary to calculate this way, because modern computers simply have no limitation to aggregate the water usage requirements of users over a moving 31-day window. There is no limitations in computers to doing that. It's a very basic calculation. It's a common calculation to have a moving window. And so that's why we've highlighted that amendments be made to Plan Change 7, and Your Honour, I'm referring to Clause 10A.4.3 in Plan Change 7.
I can see that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And so we're recommending that we remove the definition of that month from a calendar month to be more representative of a period of 31 days, or technically speaking, it's a moving average window of 31 days. And that would be more reflective of measuring the water usage and the weather patterns in central Otago. It would also limit the opportunities for underestimating the calculation of water needs by users. Lastly, I wanted to make some comments on the Plan Change 7 and its limitations to new irrigation areas. In the case of our farm, our family farm, or Southern Lakes Holdings, have already designed for and commissioned equipment to extend the irrigation areas. So we've put in pipes underground, we've put in infrastructure within our pump sheds to allow for the use of our water permits to have an additional area. So we've brought on an irrigation area of perhaps 40, 50 hectares, and it's been uneconomic for us at that time to fully install all of the equipment necessary to irrigate the entire area, which would have been 90 hectares. But we have invested already that money and that infrastructure for those increased areas of irrigation. And so what we're seeking from amendments to Plan Change 7 is that it recognise those undertaken investments into infrastructure that have either been installed or commissioned or in use prior to Plan Change 7 being notified.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honour. That's the full extent of my evidence this morning. I appreciate you considering it.
All right. Well, Mr. Moore has some questions for you, and then we'll see whether or not the members of the bench have likewise. Mr. Moore.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honour. And good morning again. I do have some questions, and I thought I might start with understanding a little more about the irrigation set up on the property. You've talked about two centre pivot irrigators. When were they installed?
The centre pivots were installed in December 14 and January 15.
And they've been operational since that time?
They've been at various stages of operation. So, Mr. Moritz, you might appreciate that in a high country element, there are a lot of landscape barriers to putting a large irrigator on that property. There are significant number of tree breaks, hillsides, creeks, all manner of landscape problems. So the progression of those irrigation systems have taken considerable number of years in order to develop their travel. Very expensive getting in excavators and earth moving equipment and all manner physical barriers to getting those implemented. So they've been at various stages over the years. They aren't entirely complete even today.
When you think about the period of time, September 2017 to March 2020, in terms of the full extent of irrigabilaria with respect to those two pivots, would most of the area have been irrigated during that period?
Well, certainly by 2020, most of the area has been irrigated, yes.
And
not at the initial stages. They would start with perhaps 10%, then move to 15% as we physically worked on those lands and redeveloped the lands, which and removal of trees and put in crossings for creeks, many creeks, and you've got, let's say, I don't know, maybe 30 wheels or, you know, 15 crossings to make.
And if I'd asked you to shade for me on a map the area of the maximum area of land under irrigation over that 3-year period, you'd be able to do that for me?
Yes, I would. Over any particular period, I'd be able to give you an estimate of that.
Now, you also mentioned that there had been some further investment made with respect to future areas of land that your company would like to irrigate, and you mentioned that some investment had been made into pumping infrastructure. Have irrigation main lines also been installed with respect to those future plans?
That's correct, and that's what I was highlighting earlier when I was presenting, is that the piping has been installed with consideration of those irrigation systems. So that isn't already installed under the ground. We have the evidence to back that up, of course. We have the engineering designs for those areas. It's really pretty obvious that that's what our intent was. This is not something where we're considering as an afterthought. The engineering reports show the amount of water that can travel within those piping systems, and those piping systems are designed for an increased capacity of water, and they are necessarily designed that way, but they are necessarily more expensive. So had we not considered irrigating those larger areas, our costs would have been significantly reduced because we simply would have used smaller pipes than were required, and that considerably reduces the costs and involved.
Now, I'm interested in the storage dam that you mentioned. When was the storage dam installed?
So the storage dam is actually an old mining dam in our case. So that was effectively installed many, many years ago. We've been fortunate to leverage an old mining dam, but we've had to make changes to that dam, of course, in order to provide for the water being stored in it and securely being installed in it and being discharged from that dam.
And have you had to get any additional Resource Management Act permits with respect to that dam?
Fortunately, not, unless I don't recall needing to go through any process with that dam, no. I don't recall having any, no.
And when you mentioned discharges from that dam, those discharges into a water race with respect to connecting up your irrigation infrastructure, or are they discharges into the stream or water body that the dam is in?
So I'm not sure I fully understand the question, but I think perhaps I can answer it anyway. The water comes by an old mining race into the storage dam, and it is discharged into that creek, which then returns to the main body of water, which is, in this case, Dunson Creek. It's a large body of water downstream.
And so the dam is authorised by the old mining deemed permits. Have I understood that correctly?
I understand that is correct, yes.
And when you made the investments in the infrastructure relying on that dam, you were aware that those deemed permits were expiring in October 2021?
I wasn't aware that they would be expiring, no. I was aware that they would be perhaps under review.
You talked about some of the challenges that you may face in respect of gathering the necessary data to show the amount of water that has historically been taken, and you referred to various weather events and the challenges that those pose. In terms of the rule framework that has now been recommended jointly by the expert planners, they have recommended the introduction of a restricted discretionary activity pathway which will apply where there are gaps in the data set such that the controlled activity pathway is not available. Are you aware of the restricted discretionary activity rule that has been recommended? Is that something you've had a chance to look at?
Yeah, Mr. Moore, that's some frustration for me because I have requested it from the Otago Regional Council directly. And in fact, if you look at my, were to have the opportunity to look at my preliminary submission to the Plan Change 7 system, which I submitted, obviously some time ago, I think it was sometime in 2020, there was a recommendation that, sorry, I just need to take a little time to find that request. Right, so on the very end of that, which is in this case page 6 of that submission, I highlight in a box on that page. I'm quite happy to allow you time to find that if you'd like.
Can you just describe really precisely what it is you're looking at so we're all looking at the same document?
So this is the submission, preliminary submission dated 25th of March 2020 by our family Southern Lakes Holdings in response to the invitation to respond by Otago Regional Council on Plan Change 7.
So have you had an opportunity to consider the restricted discretionary activity rule recommended by the planners, or is that not something that you have had an opportunity to consider?
Well, as I say, it says here in that submission, because there was a notice and there was an email and notification of Plan Change 7, which stated there is a rule for activities that do not have 5 years of data and that do not meet the plan criteria for a short-term consent. So this is what I'm presented with by Otago Regional Council. And I highlight in a box on my document, specific rules are required that make clear the treatment of activities where there is not 5 years of data available. And I have recommended that in that same box that submissions should remain open until these have been available for consideration. And specific policies should be added with consideration given to high country operations where national infrastructure, which I was referring to before in my evidence, are not available to accommodate the level of measurement required. And to my knowledge, there has been no release or in response from the Otago Regional Council on that submission that have released the specific rules to that would govern where data is not available. So I hope that answers your question. We certainly made a request for this.
Have you read any of the outputs from the planners joint witness conferencing that has taken place throughout the course of this hearing?
I've read the recent Appendix 2, which is was released on the 16th of June, yes.
And when you read that appendix, did you see that there was a restricted discretionary activity being recommended to deal with situations where there was insufficient data or a data gap?
Can you guide me as to where that is in that appendix, please?
Sure. If I can take you to Rule 10A3.1 capital A.
Yes.
And if you track down through that rule, you will see there that the council has reserved its discretion to consider whether water meter data in combination with other relevant methods and data as agreed with council accurately represents...
Which clause is this?
Right, sorry. It's over the page if you're tracking down, and I'm looking at a subparagraph A under a heading that the council will restrict its discretion to the following matters.
So this is... Sorry, we're still going to 10
point... 10.A.3.1 capital A.
Okay, I don't have that in this capital A. Oh, but 10 capital A point 3.1.
It's possible we're looking at different versions of the document. What's the precise date on the one that you're looking at?
I thought it was the 16th of June. As at 18th of June 2021.
Does that version have some blue shading in it in terms of the provisions?
Yes, it does.
Right, I think we are looking at the same version. So if you scroll down to Rule 10, capital A, point 3.1, capital A.
I've found that now, yes.
And you'll see within that rule there is some grey shading sort of on the next page.
Correct.
And then I'm drawing your attention to the second box shaded grey that commences with a subparagraph A and then a Roman 1.
Right, I'm with you, thank you.
Now, this rule is intending to respond to situations where insufficient data is available for a variety of reasons, and it seeks to provide a pathway for consideration of the use of other relevant methods to establish the amount of water taken historically.
Yeah, it's unclear to me the intent of that or what the rules are on reading that. It says that it will restrict its discretion. I'm not sure that gives us any guidance on how it will apply that discretion, which was the subject of our request in the first instance, because it's of considerable concern for us. We would like to understand the policies and how regional council might apply consideration for water usage or water needs or investments into water usage. It's very unclear from that paragraph how it might consider the application of its discretion. And that's centrally, that's the nub of the concern here, is we have no guidance on that. And from our family point of view, we have no ability to consider the impact of that on our sustainability of our farm.
Now, you mentioned in your summary this morning where you highlighted some concerns with the way by which the monthly volume was to be calculated, and you described the reference to a calendar month as somewhat arbitrary. Have you had an opportunity to test any real-world examples of the differences between a rolling 31-day average and a calendar month average?
Yes, I have. And I apologise in the instance I'm an engineer and inherently have used these mechanisms because they are quite common in my field of endeavour. I did provide considerable evidence regarding the weather patterns in the Otago region in my submission. I drew these weather patterns directly from the national database for weather patterns. So we fortunately have a weather station, a national weather station in Lauder, which is maybe 15 minutes from us. And I drew data from that, and I put that into my preliminary submission on the 25th of March. I have been able to test that. But in addition to that, the use of a moving average to represent any phenomenon or any scientific or natural phenomenon, use of a moving window average is a very common measure rather than having an arbitrary time frame that doesn't measure, doesn't relate at all to the natural pattern that we're observing.
Thank you. I have no further questions. If you could please remain for questions from the court.
Thank you, Ms. Hall.
Thank you. Commissioners, have you got any questions?
I don't have any questions. Thank you.
Right. And I don't either. So thank you very much for coming and for getting up so early. We will consider everything that you have said, including your original submission. So thank you very much.
I appreciate that consideration. Thank you, Your Honour.
Okey-doke. So we're moving to the joint empanelment of the priority witnesses. Have we got the setup? It's all set up? Okay, great. All right. Okay, so everybody who's participating, if you can come forward. Actually, I meant to ask you, Mr. Moore, did you think Ms. King would be empaneled now or later, given that, she makes but a few comments, but critical comments, and then she gives this detailed brief. How do you want to handle that?
Both. I thought that, given that she participated in the conferencing, that I might have her participate in this discussion, but that she would then be called separately in relation to her brief.
Anyone got any issues with what Mr. Moore proposes? Very well, we'll do that.
Good morning, witnesses. What I thought we might do to start is have each of you, starting with Mr. Brass, confirm your full name for the record, and at the same time confirm that you participated in joint witness conferencing and produced a joint witness statement dated 18 June 2021, and that you're a signatory to that document, which you can confirm perhaps by simply saying, I do. So starting with Mr. Brass.
My full name is Murray John Brass, and I confirm that I was part of that conferencing.
Good morning. My full name is Tom Willie de Pulsmaker, and I can confirm as well that I was part of the expert conferencing and signatory to the joint witness statement.
My full name is Timothy Alistair Dean Zensor, and I was also a part of the conferencing and a signatory to the JWS.
Morning. My full name is Sally Ann Dicey, and I confirm that I was party to the 18th of June expert conferencing in JWS.
Morning. My full name is Simon Shield-Wilson, and I confirm that I was party to the JWS.
Good morning. I'm Alexandra Lucy King, and I was also a part of the JWS on the 18th of June.
Good morning. My name is Sean William Leslie. I confirm that I was party to the joint witness statement on June 18th.
Thank you. Now, looking at the front page of the joint witness statement, it is clear that perhaps you are and appeared and participated in the conferencing in different capacities. Now, the four witnesses on the left participated as planners in terms of that conferencing, and my understanding is that the three witnesses on the right, starting with Mr. Wilson, participated not as planners but as technical witnesses. I'd be assisted if, starting with Mr. Wilson, you could explain the basis on which you were participating in the conference.
Simon Wilson, so it was as a technical witness. My team is involved in the initial rounds of compliance when it comes to working with water users. So we do the initial assessments and would, in the context of this, deal with receiving the notifications, forwarding it on if it was the council's role to do so, etc. So I'm not part of the compliance team, but I do work closely with them. So I participated in that capacity.
And Mr. Leslie, my understanding is you are also in that team and appeared in a similar capacity?
That's correct. And in addition to that, I was pulling data from the ORC's databases to feed directly into the conferencing.
And Ms. King?
Hi, Alexandra King. So I was there to assess the provisions in terms of a consenting function.
Thank you. Now, you have prepared a joint witness statement. Are there any corrections that need to be made to that statement?
Thank you. Tom de Pulsmaker. There is one. It is a tiny typo. I'm just getting to the relevant clause. It's just above the controlled activity rule. So under the heading 10A.3 rules, note 3, and under note 3, the second line, entry condition 7, that should probably be entry condition 8. Yes, absolutely. Under the heading 10A.3 rules, there are three advisory notes. The third one, on the second line, you have reference to entry condition 7, and that should be entry condition 8.
And do all witnesses agree that that correction should be made? And subject to that correction, do you all confirm that the evidence that you're about to give is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief? And for the record, all witnesses so confirmed. Now, Mr. de Pulsmaker, I understand that you have prepared a brief PowerPoint presentation highlighting the recommendations which have arisen following this joint witness conferencing. If it would assist the court, perhaps Mr. De Pauwels-Maker could take the court through.
Do we have written copies of, hard copies of that?
We can... Okay. Yes.
Right, thank you.
Thank you. I'll go through it quite quickly. When we started off the expert conferencing, the planners got together in advance because we had limited time. And the first thing we did was actually go back to the different options that have been discussed in the court and look at them with a fresh set of eyes. And going back through the court records and the transcripts, we were able to identify four different options, really. The first one is a do-nothing scenario, which in a way, the benefit of that is it's probably the simplest solution. It would keep the whole rule framework very simple, and it would achieve the outcome of having a simple and cost-effective process. But the cons of that is that really there is a risk that you're actually not achieving your goal of enabling existing activities to continue under their current scale, because abandoning the priority system might actually result in some people losing reliability of supply. The other thing as well is there might be an impact on flow regimes, and therefore you might lose in a number of streams some high values as well. So in that regard, that option didn't really achieve two pillars of the plan change, really, which is like making sure you don't lose any further environmental values and allowing existing activities to continue. The second option we looked at was relying on a voluntary approach. So stimulating catchment or water users to organize themselves in catchment groups and develop flow sharing agreements. That has some clear benefits. You'd allow them to work together on a flow regime that they can all live with. From a council point of view as well, it removes some of the difficulties in terms of implementing a system that tries to replicate priority rights. The problem there is that, and we've heard this through evidence as well, when water users develop a flow regime, it takes seasons sometimes to trial that. So it takes a lot of time to develop it. And we've heard also that you need a flow trigger, a trigger to kind of instigate it, like an incentive for people to come together. And that brings us back to the need for a minimum flow. So in absence on information to kind of set those minimum flows in all the places where they are needed, that did not seem a viable option as well, or not the best option. The third option was to set minimum flows on the main stem of the Taree and the Manaharakea, and I believe we discussed it previously in court as well. It would help to maintain the flow regime in the main stem, but minimum flows, as I said before, they don't provide much guarantees in terms of preserving flow regimes in the tributaries, especially in the Taree and the Manaharakea, where flow regimes can be determined by how much water is being released from a dam. Also, it would mean that in a number of instances in those catchments, and I'm especially thinking about the Taree, a lot of deem permits have already been replaced, so you'd have to rely on a Section 128 review for those consents. And again, with both the second and the third option, you might actually end up with flow regimes that everybody can agree on or that are clear and transparent, but that actually are different from the flow regime that exists now. So then we actually landed on the fourth option, which is just to amend the policy and the rule framework in Plan Change 7 to put an instrument in place that tries to not continue the priority rights, but replicate the effect that rights of priority currently have on flow regimes. There are some drawbacks, and you'll probably hear that from Ms. King and Mr. Cummings later on. It puts, for council, there are significant implications also for water users. But when it comes to finding an instrument that replicates that flow regime, we came to the conclusion that that is probably the best option. So we worked on that basis as well. So translating that option into an amended framework for Plan Change 7, we thought we need to amend the policy first, policy 10A21, and put in an additional limb, which basically says avoid granting consents except where on the new consents the effect of a right of priority is replicated. Then when it comes to the rule framework, what we arrived at was to have an entry condition in the controlled activity rule and also in the restricted discretionary rule that basically requires the applicant to propose in his application a condition that replicates the effect of rights of priorities. And then also we propose to set new matters of control and discretion in those respective rules as well. We also thought it would be useful to define what a right of priority is, and we based ourselves on some of the language that is in the Water and Soil Conservation Amendment Act. One of the other outcomes of the expert conferencing is that we also started working on draft consent conditions. The planners came up with a draft consent condition, two actually, one for the dominant consent holder and one for the subservient one, and both are different. To make or to kind of streamline the process, we thought it would be a good idea to include that proposed condition or those proposed conditions into the application form, and an example of the application form is included as or is appended to Ms. King's evidence. And my understanding is also that there have been subsequent amendments proposed by Mr. Cummings and Ms. King as well to make those conditions more workable from a regulatory staff and an enforcement point of view. One of the other things that we looked at was the feasibility of developing a schedule that sets out the priorities to provide transparency to plan users, being either people that want to apply for a new consent or consent officers processing those consent applications. And I tried to do that myself. I picked out three examples. Pigburn, small burn, and then also I tried to do low burn. And what I find was it works quite well when you are dealing with a small catchment with a limited number of deemed permits with priorities. It becomes quite time-consuming when you're trying to look at more complex catchments. Now, that is not the biggest hurdle. I think the biggest hurdle is that in the end, it is the objective of having a schedule is to provide transparency. And what I found with trying to tackle the low burn is you quickly actually get into a situation where it is very difficult to provide transparency in a written document. One of the reasons is because what I found, and it is probably not an isolated instance as well, is that the priorities often they exceed or they go across catchment boundaries as well. For example, some of the deemed permits in the low burn have priorities that link back to priorities in the Roaring Meg. So it becomes quite complex to kind of show that on a in a written or in a printed format. The other thing as well is when I was doing trying the schedule, I used information from the consents database. When we previously discussed, there are some inaccuracies, especially when it comes to the historic information that has been put into the database. So there is a risk that you're relying on incomplete or inaccurate information. And then there's me also as well trying to translate it into a schedule, the risk of human error. And when you compare that to the actual deemed permits, which or the mining privileges that often have those priorities listed on them in the document itself, you probably have better assurances in terms of accuracy and reliability when you go straight to the original documents than to go to the schedule. And that information is actually readily available for permit holders on their permit document. So my experience from doing that exercise was that it's not a straightforward process, and you could actually create confusion by having a schedule that is not fully accurate, and also within time things will change quite quickly as consents get renewed or the permits get renewed, so it needs to be updated very, very regularly. So yeah, there's that risk, and I think my colleagues as well, they try to do it as well, and I think they came to a similar conclusion almost. So it's better to rely actually on the actual consent documents, in my opinion. Now, I think it would be fair as well to kind of not ignore the concerns that have been raised by my colleagues as well, Ms. King and Mr. Cummings in their briefs of evidence. As I said before, there are implications for council in terms of data management, enforcement role. You might, as a council, you also have the risk of getting involved in a conflict mediation. There are implications for permit holders as well. It will mean for them that they might have to make sure that their water meters are telemetered, which is currently not the case, and not everywhere the case. Telemetry is required under the regulations, but it's going to be phased in. So what it means is that water users in some cases might have to fast track that process and put in telemetered water meters earlier than required. Also, depending on the option that we go for in terms of fine-tuning the consent conditions, one of those suggested options clearly shows that there's a significant burden of proof on dominant consent holders that want to rely on their conditions. And then finally, it can make the application process more complicated as well. Again, that's illustrated in Ms. King's evidence, especially where you're dealing with application processes where deemed permits are proposed to be split across different shareholders and they don't come in all at the same time, or where the permits are with a different priority status are proposed to be amalgamated into one consent. So, yeah. And that's where I'll leave it at that, but we're all happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. De Pelsmaker. Just a point of clarification, you noted that the witnesses agreed that option B, the recognising the effects of priorities, was the preferred option. Now, my reading of the joint witness statement was that the planners had recommended that option, but perhaps the technical witnesses had preferred an alternative option. Have I read that correctly?
That's correct, yes. Yep.
What I might do, I have some questions just to explore the joint witness statement, and on the way through that process, I'd like to tease out perhaps some of the underlying differences between the planners and the technical witnesses to perhaps better understand the positions that each of those two groups had reached throughout the conferencing. So to start that process, I'm interested to hear firstly from the planners some further information in relation to why option B, and I'm referring to paragraph 1B in terms of the option that had been preferred, as to why that option had been preferred. And I'm particularly interested in the planners addressing both the efficiency and the effectiveness of that option. So perhaps we might start by understanding when the planners were considering the efficiency of that option, what is it that they had in mind when considering that that was, in their minds, the most appropriate option?
Sorry, I'm collecting my thoughts. In terms of efficiency and effectiveness, that assessment is against the objective of the plan change, and that is to transition towards a new regime promulgated under a new planning framework. And as I said before, the efficiency with which that transition can occur is dependent on us not having to, or not losing ground in terms of the state of the environment. And I think if we replicate the effects of rights of priorities, of all the options considered, that is probably the best mechanism to ensure that those values that we're trying to protect and that we're trying not to lose during that transition period, that they are actually protected or maintained.
So when you're giving that answer, are you thinking about efficiency and effectiveness essentially as a concept conjointly? Or are you focusing just on the efficiency point in terms of the answer you've given?
Both conjointly, yeah. I would also say...
I'm looking just to understand whether what the considerations taken into account in relation to efficiency, and we'll come back to effectiveness once we've perhaps understood the efficiency component.
Yeah, with the efficiency component as well, and that's what I wanted to add on to that, we try to come up with a planning framework that provides a pragmatic response in terms of keeping the controlled activity pathway as simple as possible as well, and that is just by putting it on the new consents that replace the impermits as a standard condition, and it is basically up to the dominant consent holders to enforce, not to enforce, but to rely on those consent conditions.
Mr. Brass.
Yeah. Murray Brass, and I guess from my thinking in terms of efficiency, the preferred approach is probably not quite as efficient or simple as simply ignoring priorities entirely. But I would consider it to be the second most efficient in the sense that it's an existing regime which is already documented in terms of existing priorities and which consent holders are well used to operating under. And from that point of view, is therefore more efficient than the two other options, which would have required developing something that wasn't yet in place. But having said that, while it was the second most efficient in my mind, the effectiveness considerations then changed my view in terms of which is the preferred
Yes, and we'll come back to the effectiveness. Mr. Ensor, Ms. Dicey, are there any additions you'd like to make in terms of efficiency of the option?
No, I concur with Mr. Brass's conclusions there.
Sally Dicey, I agree. I think Mr. Brass has put that very, very neatly.
We'll move on then to understanding the effectiveness component. I'm interested to understand what it was that the planners had in mind when they were thinking about effectiveness. So what was being taken into account, and then how was that, how did the taking into account of those components contribute to the recommendation in terms of the preferred option?
Tim Ensor, I think key for me was in relation to the objectives reference to a transition rather than a step change into a new regime. So in terms of it being effective, it needed to, the recognition of priorities was key to transitioning through to a new regime, a new unknown regime, by, for want of a better term, maintaining a status quo of sorts, as opposed to what could potentially be a step change through loss of priority, where hydrology or the flow regime may change significantly from what is occurring currently. So that was a key contribution in my mind to the effectiveness of including priorities.
Do any of the other planners have an addition to make in terms of what they had in their minds when considering effectiveness?
I agree with Mr. Ensor. I would also say that one of part of the objective of the plan changes as well to enable existing activities to continue as they currently are, and it also, so carrying over or replicating the effect of rights of priorities assists in that regard as well.
We'll finish that line of questioning and then we'll take the morning break. So, Ms. Dicey, did you want to add to that?
Sally Dicey, I agree with both of my colleagues on that matter. I think the effectiveness was the real driver for this preferred option. It's really the only option that supports existing activities to carry on with regard to priorities. And covers off the kind of the dual concerns of the access to water, retaining existing access to water, plus protecting potentially some of those flow regimes and related effects from those flow regimes.
When you say the related effects, do you have in mind the incidental environmental benefits?
That's correct.
Any other comments from any of the other planners in relation to the effectiveness? Or perhaps we'll press pause for now and take the morning adjournment.
All rise.